supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little later in the show, a technique we get a lot of questions about. People want more information about growing potatoes above ground in a potato tower, and we're going to deliver it in the question of the week. We're also going to talk to a researcher about the threat of giant mosquitoes coming our way from Florida. That's a lot to get done, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Scott, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. It's an honor to talk to you. I'm calling you from Rosholt, Wisconsin, where we're supposed to get 4 inches of snow tonight.
That's why they call it spring, Scott.
Oh, it's been a long winter. Mike, what I got going is I plan on putting some raspberries in a section of lawn. I got one of those rear tine tillers. I'm going to take out about 4 to 5 inches of dirt, put newspaper down on the bottom once I remove that dirt, and fill that void entirely with a really good grade of compost that is made locally. I got a rhizome barrier so the lawn can creep in, my raspberries can creep out. Are they going to do okay planted in just pure compost?
Oh, no. No, no. Everything you've described here is bizarro land. And the bottom line is raspberries need to spread to be productive. They can be contained in a certain area, but not in a small area. If you only have a limited amount of space and the space gets full sun and you want small fruit, I would push you in the direction of blueberries, because that's a bush that can be planted in specialized soil and it'll stay in place and your rhizome barrier will maybe keep the lawn away. But raspberries need to spread. They need to be able to send up new shoots in new places every year to be productive. And compost should never be wasted on raspberries. Raspberries are one of these strange plants that do best in really lousy soils, really poor, nutrient-lacking, unamended soils. As long as the soil drains well and doesn't hold water, raspberries will thrive there. And for some weird reason, if you're nice to raspberries, if you feed them, if you take good care of them, if you give them rich compost, they'll just fall over and die and get little X's over their eyes.
My rows were going to be around 90 feet long and about 2 feet wide.
Oh, okay. That's a nice space. And how many canes were you planning on starting out with?
Well, my brother has a large patch. He said I can have 300-400 if I want them.
Okay. That's very good. That's the best way, by the way, to start with raspberries, when you can go over in the spring, whenever you get spring, and lift up some of the new green shoots. It's really going to be a bear to keep that lawn away, man. You know, grass is the most invasive weed that there is. So I would make that rhizome barrier really strong. And then you can till up the soil that's there, but don't make it nice. These things prefer to live in a boarding home with bed bugs and mice, not a lush hotel, not the Four Seasons. So you want the soil there to be poor. You want it to drain well. And then you don't have to go nuts putting in a lot of canes, because you want to give them room to spread. They are happiest when they can have many children and the children can live in the same neighborhood. Really, just transplant the canes that have real good root systems. Do not improve the soil. If you don't trust me, if you don't believe me, you may spread like an inch of compost on the surface when you're all done planting them. But not too much, and don't improve the soil in the hole, for goodness sake. That's the opposite of what raspberries want.
Okay, that makes sense. I have 50 blueberries, and I know I grow grapes, and I know grapes want absolutely no soil improvement also. When I dig out the raspberry from my brother's raspberry patch, how deep do I have to take these roots?
The best time to do it is when the soil is really wet, when the weather is cloudy, when it's a really rainy period in the spring. Then you have a lot more leeway. I have gotten shovels full where I've gotten two or three new canes with a lot of their roots attached, and that's a gimme. But sometimes, you know, you just wind up pulling these things from the ground and you only have a couple of roots. So if you're going to pull 100 new canes out of the ground, you don't really care. Don't worry about any that don't make it. Be heartless. But yes, you're absolutely right. They want the same kind of soil as grapes, which is no nutrition. That's where you get, conversely, who knows why, but that's when you get the most intensely flavored fruit.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
All right, Scott. Good luck, man.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jessica, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. How are you doing today?
I am doing just fine, Jessica. How are you?
I'm great.
And where is Jessica Great?
Edmond, Oklahoma.
Right next to Oklahoma City, our good friends down there.
Right.
All right, what can we do for Jessica in Oklahoma?
Well, when I was cleaning out my garden at the beginning of this year, when I was cleaning out all the weeds and grass that had come up over the winter, I kicked over one of those stones I have in my garden, and there was a huge nest of ants. And I tried to research it to see if ants were beneficial or not, and I really didn't come up with anything decisive on that.
Right, and these are not red ants. These are not fire ants. These are
they're black ones. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, you raise a very interesting question, and I would say that the jury is somewhere between out and indecisive on this. Ants are both good and bad in a garden situation. The good things they do are they aerate the soil tremendously. By making all their little runs and tunnels, they keep the soil nice and loose.
Okay.
Ants also eat a lot of buried weed seeds, which are a real big problem in vegetable gardens. Ants eat a lot of seeds, and most of the seeds that are laying in the ground in a vegetable garden are things we don't want to sprout. So they are beneficial that way. Where you are, as you go further south in the country, ants become more beneficial because they are the natural enemies of termites. So when you have a big ant colony like that, termites will not come near your garden or perhaps even your property to some degree. Very rarely will ants bother small plants. Sometimes it can happen, but in my experience, it's mostly like in a drought crisis situation, which again, we're talking about Oklahoma.
That's very true.
When there's a great lack of other food, they may bother garden plants. But it's not a big issue, except maybe with direct seeding.
Yeah.
They may try to make off with some of the seeds, or they may not if there's enough normal food around. I would say if there's adequate rainfall, there's less of a chance of that. The biggest pestiferous problem that ants can cause is they farm aphids. You know, aphids, the plant-sucking pest, the little insects that will completely cover things like roses and peppers.
Yeah.
Well, ants are dairy farmers of aphids. If you've ever had aphids on a rose or a pepper plant or something else, you'll notice that it gets covered with like a black soot.
Yeah.
That is their quote-unquote honeydew. That's what comes out of their rear end. And it is very sweet and sugary. And so ants feed on it and they protect them. There was this great movie years ago in the late 90s called Microcosmos, where it had all this miniature photography and close-ups of things that you've never seen before, like the whole screen filled with the head of a praying mantis. They had images of ants on plants that were covered by aphids and a ladybug flying in. The ant rears up on its hind legs and starts hitting the ladybug like a boxer.
Oh my gosh.
To protect. It's like dairy cows to them. So that's the balance. They're aerating the soil. They're eating weed seeds. They're keeping termites at bay. And if they're going to be a problem, they will show you, you know, seeds will disappear or that you'll start to have aphid problems. And if that happens, it's very easy to eliminate the colony with boric acid bait traps.
That makes a lot of sense because I planted carrots and green onions by seed in my garden where everything else I started inside under a grow light.
Right.
And I have had nothing come up from my carrots and my onions.
I think there's probably a good chance that the ants have eaten those seeds.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
What I would recommend is go online, go to our website, go to You Bet Your Garden,
mm-hmm.
go to Garden Answers A to Z, and underneath ants, there are some cautions about using boric acid bait traps outside, you know, because they have a sweet bait. Some bees can come to them. So we describe how to, you know, put the baits under a shoebox or something like that so the ants can get at them, but bees can't.
Okay.
And that'll wipe out the colony. If they're eating your seeds, they've already become pests. Pestiferous.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time. You completely answered my question.
It's a great topic. It fascinates entomologists.
And what was that movie called one more time?
The movie was Microcosmos.
That's it.
All right. Good luck, Jess.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Good day. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody not to plant their crops this summer in the ground if nighttime temps are still dipping into the 40s. And also protect their tender little plants from overly hot days by planting in the early evening as opposed to first thing in the morning. Evening planting gives the plants plenty of time to get established before they have to endure that first day of full sun. But don't go looking for more planting tips at the A to Z section of our archives just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, the threat of giant mosquitoes heading our way, and how to grow potatoes above ground in a tower. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants. Tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up, potatoes in a tower. A lot of garden soil out there is just too heavy and dense to grow good potatoes in. And the digging is a drag, and sometimes when you harvest, you destroy half your potatoes. So we're going to talk about growing them above ground in a potato tower. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But first, we must investigate the threat of giant mosquitoes coming in from Florida to fly away with small children. With Dr. Philip Kaufman, Associate Professor of Veterinary Entomology at the University of Florida at Gainesville. Dr. Kaufman, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, I'm happy to join you.
You've been in the news quite a bit lately, warning that a new mosquito is poised to invade the United States by way of Florida. This is a very large mosquito?
It is a very large mosquito, but unfortunately a number of misconceptions have been put out in the media on this, and a number of them need some clarification.
All right, let's clean it up.
All right. The first thing is it's a native species. It's not new to Florida. In fact, it occurs in the eastern two-thirds of the United States already. It has been here longer than humans have been in North America.
But it is not well known. I mean, even though the, quote, regular mosquitoes are so small, we certainly notice them. I can't remember being bitten by a large mosquito, or does it look like something else? Does it look like a biting fly?
No, it does look like a mosquito, but it looks like a very large one. You know, this mosquito is large for a mosquito. If you laid one on the end of your index finger, it maybe would go halfway across, maybe two-thirds of the way across your index finger. So they're not as large as they've been portrayed in many media sites. In Florida, they occur when we have some of these very large rainfall events, such as tropical storms and hurricanes that leave just tremendous volumes of water in our low-lying habitats. Florida is very much sandy, and so water soaks into the ground very quickly. So a normal 1 or 2 inch rainfall that might leave standing water in low areas of fields in and around Philadelphia, that water wouldn't be around for more than a day or two in Florida. And so for us to get standing water, it requires, you know, 5-10 inch rainfall events, which we don't really get unless we have these tropical storms.
So that's really good, because if Florida had our clay soils, you wouldn't be able to see the other Floridians for the giant hordes of mosquitoes in between you and them.
You're right. But if we had clay soils, as you do up there, many of the low areas in Florida would be lakes, and then they wouldn't support this mosquito. So the mosquito only occurs in freshwater in temporary water sites. It does not come out of ponds or streams or lakes. And so we get these cycles of water, no water, and then water again, which stimulates the eggs that the females laid in the soil to hatch. Those mosquitoes require a week or 2 weeks of that standing water to be produced, but the water doesn't last continuously. Otherwise, there'd be fish and other things in there that would eat the mosquitoes.
You almost sound like you're describing the amphibian explosion I'm personally waiting for, when these vernal pools of spring give birth to these once a year kind of wonderful life forms, like frogs, toads, and lightning bugs.
Yeah, it's a species that takes advantage of the conditions that are presented to it. You know, the females don't randomly lay their eggs. They recognize through smells that the soil type has the right bacteria and whatnot that indicate it's going to be a flooded area. And she'll deposit her eggs, and those eggs can sit in the soil for years waiting for a rainfall event. Last summer, we had Tropical Storm Debbie that went across North Florida, and we hadn't had a large rainfall event like that for several years. And so all of a sudden, this mosquito, as well as a number of other species that develop in these low habitats, were kind of freed from their stasis. And they all developed at once, and a week or two after the storm went through, we had tremendous numbers of mosquitoes emerge. And they stuck around for a few weeks, and as they died out and the water drained into the ground, the mosquitoes kind of went away. This particular mosquito really is what we call a rural species. It doesn't develop in human-created civilization where, you know, we pave the streets and create a retention pond. That's not where these are coming from. It's when you venture into the rural areas or into the forests that you would encounter this particular mosquito.
And really only within a certain amount of time after a heavy wet event.
Correct.
That is so different than the life cycle of the mosquito I'm used to, which is a constant breeder, you know, building up population throughout the summertime. Is this a unique form of mosquito in its breeding habits? You almost sound like you're describing some of these crazy toads that can live underneath the desert for years waiting for a rain, right?
Well, in essence, they can. They just stay in the egg stage until the conditions are correct for them to emerge and develop. And then they do so very quickly to ensure that, you know, the water doesn't dry out before they're finished. But many of the mosquitoes that people encounter, certainly here in Florida, and you have one of these mosquitoes up in your area now, is the Asian tiger mosquito. And it's what we call a container breeder. And so humans leave things all around their yards. They put in bird baths and they have gutters that aren't cleaned and hold water and kids' toys in the yards. That's a different type of mosquito that uses those habitats. And those mosquitoes tend to be very associated with feeding on people.
One thing that a fellow garden communicator of mine, Howard Garrett, down in Texas, has advised, and we've endorsed on this show, is specifically setting out traps. I noticed from your bio that you have done a lot of work in biological control, so you're familiar with BTI, the naturally occurring mosquito larvicide. And what Howard has suggested, and I've picked up and suggested myself, is to deliberately leave out sources of standing water, but treated with BTI so that these Asian tiger and other mosquitoes would lay their eggs in the water, but then the eggs would not proceed to adulthood. It doesn't sound like this would work for your, quote, giant mosquito.
That wouldn't work for the giant mosquito because of where they develop. And so for this mosquito, there really isn't a lot you can do to reduce the populations, but you have to remember that it's an opportunistic feeder of mammals. When they've done studies on what does it feed on, almost always it comes back as the two most common hosts are cattle and deer. And then it'll also feed on other small mammals that it encounters, you know, raccoons and possums and that sort of thing. It'll certainly feed on people, but it does so when it encounters them, when we kind of go into their habitat. It's not one that is so focused on humans the way the Asian tiger mosquito is.
And you've said the news reports of the dangers are aggravated. Now, of course, you're an entomologist yourself, so you can look at this dispassionately, but you can imagine being in any kind of media and hearing the phrase giant mosquito. How can we not run with that with both legs full out? You know,
I understand that. Some of the size comparisons and the amount of blood that it proposes that it takes, those things are just been sensationalized. It's only a half an inch long, and so it's not the size of a bird.
No, when I'm doing personal appearances, I'm going to tell people this mosquito is so big that when it takes a blood meal from you, there's another mosquito in a nurse's outfit ready to give you orange juice afterwards and a little I gave blood thing for your lapel. Now, it sounds like this mosquito is pretty self-controlled in that it only exists at certain times of the year, certain environmental conditions, doesn't feed on people primarily. We have heard the bite is like that of a black fly. Is that correct?
Well, I've been bitten by it, and to me, it's not quite as bad as a black fly. I've been bitten by both. But, you know, like a pinprick would be how I would describe it. But the itching and the bump afterwards are no different than any other mosquito.
You're not helping sell newspapers.
I know. And the insect repellents work perfectly fine against it. And so if people are smart about how they protect themselves, they really would not have a problem with this. Most people will never encounter this mosquito, and our mosquito control districts down here do a fantastic job with managing not just this mosquito, but others. And in the long run, this mosquito is not capable of transmitting the viruses that cause illness in people.
So that really poses no danger whatsoever.
Right. We have other mosquitoes that we would be more concerned about if conditions are correct for virus transmission. And our state mosquito control districts and university in the state of Florida monitor those groups of viruses and the mosquitoes, and they take action as necessary to kind of break that disease cycle.
We've been calling this thing, quote, the giant mosquito, which of course is kind of rude. What is the name of this creature?
Its scientific name is Saurophora ciliata, and it's probably the second largest mosquito in Florida. There is a bigger one that does not feed on blood.
Really?
Like this one does as well. Both of those species, the immatures, will feed on other mosquitoes when they're immatures. So in some ways, this one's a little beneficial, but it's not worth encouraging them to develop because they are very aggressive biters and can be kind of pestiferous.
All right. Well, we thank you for clearing it up. We can now tell our listeners that giant mosquitoes the size of compact cars are not flying out of Florida to prey upon public radio listeners or around the nation, and that this is simply one of many interesting members of a very large family that's been around forever and kind of has one of the most interesting life cycles of any mosquito I've encountered.
Yep, they're very neat. For a mosquito, it's very attractive. Take a look at it before you swat it away.
All right, Dr. Philip Kaufman, Associate Professor of Veterinary Entomology at the University of Florida at Gainesville. Thank you for joining us on You Bet Your Garden.
All right, thank you.
And we'd like to offer our special thanks to Cecily Garber for her help with that interview. And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Kate, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Kate. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you today?
I am excellent. Thank you for asking. And where is Kate fine?
Kate is calling from Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Excellent. Right across the Ben Franklin Bridge from our world headquarters here.
You got it. I'm very familiar with Philadelphia, born and raised.
But now you live in Jersey.
Yeah, now we're over the bridge in Jersey. And my husband and I and our children finally, after years of threatening to do so, grew tons of veggies from seed indoors. And we built our own raised beds.
Really?
And they are beautiful and magnificent. But we were listening to your show last week, and you were talking about raised beds, and someone had called in with a question about mixing different kinds of soil within different, I guess, different containers, whether they're window boxes or raised beds, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Pete and I were wondering, when we filled the beds with soil, he had composted soil delivered, and that's what we use to fill the beds.
Okay.
So our question is, should we be mixing this compost soil with something else?
Well, see, you don't know what you have. There is no such thing as composted soil. It could be anything. I would have to see it. You know, soil itself looks like dirt, and compost looks rich and black, more like coffee grounds.
Well, now, that's sort of what this looks like. And so I think that my husband, he had the stuff delivered. It specifically has the name compost in it.
What you need to do first is call back the people who delivered it and ask some direct questions.
Okay.
You know, is this yard waste compost? Is this topsoil? What was exactly in it? Now, you said you started your own plants from seed this year indoors. Did you buy artificial lights and everything?
No. We have a bay window attached to like a large peninsula island in our kitchen that gets really good light.
Yeah.
And so we bought the little seed starter kits at Home Depot, and the girls and I picked out what we wanted to do, and we started them and created the little like greenhouse cover, and they grew, and then we transplanted them to a little bit bigger containers but still kept them indoors. And then once we knew the frost was gone, I mean, everybody in our neighborhood is like, you guys are crazy, you've done this too early, but we got a little excited, and
yes,
so far they're doing really, really well.
Well, they probably didn't get enough light inside. It's
okay.
It's not the daytime temperatures that matter. It's the nighttime temperatures. So you really don't want to put frost-sensitive plants outside until the nights stay reliably in the 50s. And most people, when they raise plants indoors for the first time, especially without artificial light, the plants really struggle. So you want to find out what you got. If it was compost, then don't add anything. But you want to ask them what kind of compost, how was it made, where was it from? They should be able to answer those questions.
Okay.
I think you should go to a garden center and you should buy a couple of pre-started plants that were started professionally and put them into the same raised beds and see how they do. Because there's a lot of variables here. Seed starting is very difficult. Seed starting successfully is much more difficult than outdoor gardening.
Okay.
And you may have jumped the gun. I think in the time that has passed since you put these things in the ground, we've had some really cold nights.
He did create like a nice little warm tarp and like cover everybody over and insulate them and all that stuff.
No. See,
you know,
that's
but not enough.
No, that's death. You know, bad. Yes, that's very bad. There's special material to cover new plants with called floating row cover.
Okay. Oh my goodness, we've done it all wrong.
but you weren't asking anybody. You were freelancing.
I know.
You were freelancing at all, and this stuff is not intuitive. But there's plenty of time. If things are not working out well, you should never be afraid to use store-bought plants the first year you're gardening. And then second, find out exactly what's in that raised bed. And if it is just some sort of weird topsoil, when they're confronted, go out and buy some really good yard waste compost. That's black compost made from shredded fall leaves. And spread that an inch thick on the top. And don't put any more plastic or tarps or anything like that over tops of the plants. That can kill them in hours.
Oh, wow.
And again, that's why you've never seen it. So
We don't have a lot of people around in our neighborhood. Like, we don't have any friends who have done this necessarily. So we really, other than Googling, we're really kind of flying blind, which is why I called you the expert.
Right, exactly. It's tough to find good information on the internet without having done it, and then you know the information. So what I want you to do is go to our archives. Go to You Bet Your Garden. Go to the A to Z Garden Answers. I want you to read the article on first-year gardeners, on raised beds, on seed starting, and on the compost definitions. I want you to read the article about compost definitions before you call the guy who delivered this soil so that you know the questions to ask and you won't be bamboozled. But if it's good soil in there and your plants are struggling, a combination of first year starting and being out on two cold nights, there is no shame in replacing them with store-bought plants, and you'll gain a lot of experience for next year. The good part is you still have the entire growing season ahead. You should be able to do fabulous, but don't fall in love with these plants because they had a very bad childhood education.
That we were being like the best parents ever. See that? We should have had like a background check run or something. Oh, Mike, you've been wonderful. Thank you so much for your help. I really appreciate you answering my questions.
And one way or another, you're going to have a great garden this year. So
I hope that's the
important thing. All right, Kate, you take care.
Thanks, Mike. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll make my final appearance of the season on Sunday, June 9th at the 20th Annual Earth Fair in Smithville, New Jersey. It's a great day of music, activities, family, fun, and me. That's the 20th Annual Earth Fair in Smithville, New Jersey on Sunday, June 9th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to grow potatoes in a tower above ground. I'm Above Ground Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Growing potatoes above ground. No, trash cans are not the ideal environment, but a very familiar structure is, and you'll grow perfect potatoes without any digging and utilize your space well. We'll reveal all the interesting details after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Alice, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. How are you?
I am well, Alice, and thank you. Where are you?
I have a home in Honeybrook, Pennsylvania, just up the highway from you.
Well, it depends on where you think I am on the highway. Where is Honeybrook?
Honeybrook is about 50 miles outside of Philadelphia, and I am probably about not even 1 mile away from the Lancaster County borderline in Gap.
Oh, okay, very good. So you're west.
Yes.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Alice in Honeybrook?
Well, we have a whole new construction site going on.
Good.
And they have just done some excavating and about to put down the, what do you call that, topsoil on it.
Okay.
And my husband wants to go to the big building lumber store to get some grass seed and hay. And I said, don't. Let's call Mike.
Yeah, not this time of year, unfortunately.
Okay.
This is not the time of year when you can successfully put in a cool season lawn. If you were to seed a cool season lawn now, you'd have to do it over again in August. Your choices right now, especially in your climate out towards Lancaster County, are to install zoysia grass plugs, which are a warm season lawn. That's the grass that goes tan and dormant over the winter.
Okay.
But it loves hot summers. Or you could put in sod, which is very expensive once you get to a big area. And I know a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their head around the concept because springtime is planting time. But in the same way as you would fail in planting spring bulbs or garlic or any of the other plants that must go in the fall, spring-sown lawns always fail here. What happens is when the soil finally gets warm enough to germinate the grass seed, it is now getting too hot outside for the young grass plants. There are no grasses that are native to the United States, no lawn grasses that we use. So we have to take grasses from Europe or Asia. And the predominant grasses we use are from the United Kingdom, and they're not very heat tolerant. Now, by installing them in mid-August, they then grow up in progressively cooler weather. They go through a winter. They go through a cool spring. So by the time summer comes, they're a year old and ready to rock and roll.
But they're pretty rooted. I guess their roots have taken hold.
Exactly. And they also have a lot of biomass. By the time they have to endure the heat stress that is their biggest enemy, they're almost a year old. Whereby if you just have little baby wisps of grass that have just come up, they just burn to a crisp in the summer heat, and you wind up wasting all that time, seed, and energy. And you probably would have fed a lot of mice and voles and stuff like that. And when you finally do it, I don't understand this concept of, hey, I have a whole box full of emails right now from people whose lawns are half grass and half hay, and what do they do with it? And I go back in time, read my advice, and don't smother your emerging lawn with any kind of mulch. Just keep it moist as it's coming up, and it'll do fine. I never understood this concept of hay on top of a lawn.
Well, hopefully he's going to listen to you and not me. Because if I said do it, he will not listen. So if you say do it, he'll probably listen and not put that hay down. I appreciate it. Now, that zoysia grass you were talking about, where do I find that at?
Zoysia grass comes in plugs and sprigs, and you order it mail order. And that's a warm season grass, so it gets installed in the spring. You would put the plugs and the sprigs in, and you would keep it watered. As the summer progresses, zoysia grass gets stronger. It'll fill in by the end of the season. Now, it does turn tan and go dormant over the winter, but it's green in the summer, and you'll never see a weed in it. Other than that, I mean, if he insists on doing something, he can go out and get what's called a nurse grass, and he can sow that, and that might survive a little bit by the summer. But no matter what, if you want a bluegrass or a fescue lawn, you're going to have to do it mid-August to early September, whether you do it now or not.
Okay.
Sorry.
I appreciate it. Well, some advice is better than no advice, right?
That's right. You can borrow my time machine. You know.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. Good luck, Alice.
Thanks, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Gordon, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm okay, Gordon. How are you?
Doing well. It's a beautiful day here. Finally, looks like we're finally going to get some spring or even summertime weather coming up on us now.
Bite your tongue, turn around three times, and spit, because in the past, when I say that, it snows the next day.
Yeah, I know. It's happened to me before, too.
All right. What can we do for Gordon in Doylestown?
Well, with all the freaky weather we've had lately and the Hurricane Sandy coming through and a lot of high winds this spring, I lost a whole bunch of mature trees that just toppled over during Sandy. And I'm not a gardener, but I am an arborist enthusiast, and I have a plum tree, an ornamental plum tree in my backyard that has been progressively, it was never planted straight, it's been progressively going over a few degrees here and there. And just last week, I thought, you know, one more heavy windstorm, it's going over, and boy, I'm going to catch hell with my wife. So I got my come along out, re-righted the tree, and staked it. So it's pretty much 90 degrees with the ground. Haven't destroyed any of the roots. It's very healthy. It just flowered. My question is, will it rewrite itself so that I can eventually take the stakes off of it in a few years? What's your opinion on that?
I don't see this tree surviving staked for more than a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
When we have Superman come by and you know, push a tree back upright, and then we tie it all up and stake it down. The danger was not to the roots. I mean, if you're an amateur arborist, you move trees around. You know, you can sever roots, but put the tree back in the ground and it'll recover. But no tree can handle being girdled by something around its circumference, or even, I think, the stress of being pulled in a crazy direction. I mean, this may sound stupid, but wasn't it doing a darn good imitation of a weeping plum?
In a way, but I think that it would have just gone right over in the next big turn, because it was starting to get close to that 45-degree angle, and it's got a pretty substantial root ball on it, too, when it was planted a few years back. So I thought that maybe it would kind of gimbal its way back, but I don't think I turned the root ball at all. I just kind of righted it in a way. Do you think I should release the tension on it and just kind of maybe let it lean and have its roots develop more in that leaning position?
Well, when did you put it into bondage?
Almost 2 weeks ago.
Okay, so about 2 weeks ago. And you say it flowered since?
Yes.
Right, which is either a really good sign or a really bad sign. We don't know yet. And it's leafing out normally and everything like that?
Yes, yes. It seems very happy.
What do you have wrapped around the trunk?
The wire, I do have a hose protecting the bark from the wire that is attached to the stakes in the ground.
Okay, and the tension is strong.
The tension's real strong, yeah.
Yeah, no, that wire is cutting into the cambium already. So, yeah, I would ditch the wire. And then if you can support it softly with a little bit of cloth or just the hose itself, but without without strong tension, because every action has an equal and opposite reaction. That tension is digging into the bark slowly. So that's no good for the tree. So I think the wire has to go ASAP. But then the first week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks after flowering are when the tree is at its strongest. The flowers are gone.
The flowers have gone, yes.
How tall is the tree?
It's probably 12 to 15 feet tall.
What I would suggest is get rid of that wire. Give the tree a good pruning. Now that it's finished flowering, this is the perfect time to do it. Reduce some of the weight. See how clever you can be with the pruning to make the tree look more correct to your eye. And then if you want to try to give it some support, it has to be gentle support. It's holding, you can hold the child's hand, but don't dislodge its shoulder trying to help it.
Got it.
All right, man?
Beautiful. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, man.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, which we're calling Potatoes in a Cage. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, read this week's questions, s'il vous plaît.
Sure, Mike. We heard from Rachel in Effingham, Illinois, who writes, "What's your take on growing potatoes in garbage cans? I was told it was easier to harvest because you don't have to dig them out of the ground, and it contains them in a smaller area. True?" We also heard from Dave in Newark, Delaware, who writes, "Last year I tried planting potatoes in 32-gallon trash cans. I drilled 1-inch diameter holes in the sides and lined the bottoms with galvanized mesh. I put 6 inches of potting mix in the bottom of each can, put the seed potatoes in, covered them with mix, and as the plants grew, regularly added more mix, leaving just the topmost leaves exposed, until the buckets were full and the plants were growing out the top. One set of purple potatoes grew well, but the Yukon Golds wilted and the stems just fell out of the soil. What did I do wrong?"
Well, I'm surprised that any of your trash can spuds survived, Dave. Your technique of constantly adding soil over top of potatoes that were buried, 3 or 4 feet down? Sounds more like the way you're supposed to grow leeks or blanch asparagus. I fear that your spuds used up all their inherent energy just trying not to be smothered to death. Now, the basic idea of growing potatoes in some kind of above-ground container is a very good one, as it eliminates the problems of trying to grow potatoes in dense, heavy garden soil and the damage that occurs to the tubers at digging up time. But you want something with a wide top so it can accommodate multiple sets of the above-ground green plants that fuel the growth of the underground tubers. A more normally shaped container, say like the 17-inch planters I recommend for growing big tomato plants, would be much better, as their width nicely balances their depth. Come to think of it, if your cans are plastic, you can cut them in half across the middle and get 2 reasonable-sized planters. Fill the bottom 2/3 of the container with the lightest, loosest combination of soil-free mix and compost you can achieve. Place 1 to 3 certified disease-free seed potatoes on top of the soil, 1 spud for each 5 to 10 gallons of compost and mix, and then fill the pot up the rest of the way with more compost and mix. The green growth will be able to easily break the surface without expending a lot of energy, and with any luck, the containers will be filled with fresh, sweet, juicy potatoes at the end of the season. Or you could harvest them as young, new potatoes in August, and then use the container to grow cool season crops like salad greens. But there's an old trick that allows you to grow lots more potatoes above ground in a less conventional type of container. And when I alluded to it on a show last season, we got a slew of emails from gardeners all the way from Philly to Spokane asking for details on, quote, Mike's method of growing potatoes vertically in a type of compost bin. Hardly my idea. This trick was a favorite with the readers of Organic Gardening magazine during the time I was editor, and it really maximizes production while utilizing space well. You can either build your own potato bin or use a classic Lehigh-style composter, a 4x4x4 box made of wooden slats that alternate with open spaces, So there's a slat, an open space the size of a slat, another slat, and so on up to the top. You fill the bottom of the bin with soil-free mix and compost until you reach the top of the first or second slat. Then you place one seed potato on each side of the bin, on top of the soil and centered next to an opening a few inches back. Then you add more soil and compost till you reach the next set of openings. Place four more seed potatoes, add more soil, and continue until you get to the top. The greenery that emerges from each seed potato will grow out of the nearest side opening and towards the light, fueling the growth of an enormous number of spuds in the center of the bin. When you reach the top, add a last layer of potatoes, more compost, and mix, and then mulch the surface well with shredded leaves as soon as those top plants appear. Keep the bin well watered. All that airflow and plant growth will use up water quickly. And make sure the top stays really well mulched over the course of the growing season. You never want your actual tubers to be exposed to light, just their above-ground green growth. Typically, such a bin will vanish in a sea of green by mid-season, with the lush plant coverage providing extra protection from light for the developing spuds. Enjoy the beautiful potato flowers when they appear on the plants, but cut them off as soon as they start to fade. Give the bin a nice organic feeding mid-season, let the plants die back naturally at the end of the summer, and then lift up the sides of the bin and collect your potatoes. You'll get the maximum number possible without any digging. Well, that sure was some interesting information about growing potatoes above ground now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where it'll have links to lots more information about successful potato growing. Just click the question of the week link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to plant me in a bin if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse, teeming towards our garden shore. At garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject in the subject line. And perhaps you should check voice to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems. Hint, hint, just like yours. Hint, hint. In our Garden Answers A to Z section, listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Jaunty John Knapp. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminati. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at our Facebook page. Our editor is Idaho-grown Al Banks. Our underground intern is Jolie Higazi. The completely above ground, above board, and above it all, Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm in the dark being fed. Hey, wait a minute. That doesn't smell like compost. I wondered what that horse was doing here. Mike McGrath. But I clean up nice, and so I will see you before you smell me next week. Are we under a blight watch again this season? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal what's new in the world of late blight on tomatoes and the blight that impales impatience. Plus your fabulous phone calls.